Accession number 19058, Reel 1.
Philip Good, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Right here, in Bishop Stainton, just a few yards up the road, actually.
Which year was this?
This was 1920, on the 8th of April.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Bishop Stainton?
Oh yes, I'm what can be called a local yokel.
And how old were you when you left school?
I can remember the day I went to school, and that was when I was 3 years old. I still remember it. But not many people can remember, can they, at 3 years old?
No. Well, how old
I
were
do.
You when you left?
I left this school at 11, and then went to Tynmouth School, because this was then, by this time it had become a junior school. I was then school bused every day into Tynmouth, to the West Lawn School at Tynmouth.
How old were you when you left there?
I left at 14.
So that would have been 34?
1934.
Did you get a job?
Oh, gosh, yes, it was a bespoke job. It was here with my father, who had buses and taxis and a delivery service. He used to have buses running between Bishop Stainton and Tynmouth and Bishop Stainton and Newton Abbott, the local bus service.
Were you doing that job when war was declared?
Yes. By that time, we'd had a goods vehicle to do light removals and cartage of antiques and things like this. Yes, I was 20 on the 8th of April 1940, by which time I would be called up sooner or later, but I preferred to think of myself as a volunteer rather than someone who's been called up.
But before that, when war was declared by Neville Chamberlain on the 3rd of September 1939, did you actually hear that broadcast?
Yes. Have I got time for a 3 or 4 minute story about
Please.
That? My father, mother, neighbours were crowded around the radio, the wireless, and all very tearful. The most momentous broadcast ever made in this country, I should think. That was when he declared, and as a consequence, England is at war with Germany. That was, I think, 11 o'clock on the 3rd of September 1939. Immediately after lunch, a large black super humber snipe came up the road and stopped outside our place. And two gentlemen in very smart city suits came and asked if they could come in and speak to my father. And they said, "We understand you have a van." Yes, we had a van. Could they make an urgent booking to collect from the shop in Tynmouth, where the Daily Mirror had had the exhibition that was touring the country of the replica crown jewels? And they wanted the replica crown jewels, or they said the boxes, this was the word they said, the boxes collected from the shop, which was an empty shop between leases, which was being used on this touring exhibition by the Daily Mirror. Could we be there between 8 and 9 to load the crates and take them to Bodmin Jail, where they would be stored in the cellar? And they said, "We won't haggle about the price, just do this. We know you won't cheat us." Well, the next day we turned up, and we were surprised, because when we saw those boxes arrive beside our bus stop at the Triangle in Tynmouth, they came in cardboard cartons and tea chests, and they were carried very lightly. When we got there on the morning of the 4th of September 1939, they were in large, heavy deal boxes, crates, and they really were heavy. And while we were loading, the antique dealer came around the corner and said to my father, Hey, Doug, what the hell was happening last night? There was toing and coming and banging all through the night. What's happened? I think you can work out what's happened. It was a switch. We know it was a switch. And we are so proud. And my father got us together after the delivery had been made and made us, said, I don't want to charge for this, but they insisted that he did. For security, you ought to keep your mouth shut. This is a security matter. You know, you're guessing what's happened, but don't say anything. We never did. Not until after the war, when we heard from the brigadier at the tower.
So they were the real crown jewels?
Whether it was the complete collection of the crown jewels, I wouldn't know. May have been, may not. But I do remember the sigh of relief the two gentlemen in city suits gave after they were safely behind, where they went down the flagstones into the bowels of Bodmin Jail, and then they went behind the bars, which clanked and was securely locked, and they gave a sigh of relief. And they more or less hinted to my father, well done, you've made a bit of history, sort of thing. We were so proud of this.
But the replica crown jewels were supposed to have been on tour?
I went during my army service to the tower, and there was an ex-regimental sergeant major of the Coldstream who was, well, beef-eater, showing people around, and there, within the very thick glass, not very good light, behind the views, there were, well, on display, there was the display. He said, there you are, ladies and gentlemen, that shows we're not afraid of Hitler's bombs, you see? And he gave a half wink. I think he knew they were the replicas. They would never have put the crown jewels, not in that vulnerable position, but they were on show, and everyone was most impressed. They're not afraid of Hitler's bomb. Look at that. There's confidence for you. Marvellous.
But was there some Daily Mail organisation of...
Daily Mirror.
A Daily Mirror organisation. What were they actually doing?
It was publicity for the Daily Mirror. They were showing off the crown jewels with explanations of the Imperial and the Irish and the Indian Empire. They were showing them off. My golly, they were clever. They were papier-mâché with glass, but they were clever. They really were excellent. And people would crowd to see the replica crown jewels and wonder at the splendour of it all.
And this was going around the country?
It was going around the country. And every day the Daily Mirror would publicise where it was, which part of England it was being shown.
And it just so happened?
It just so happened that on the 2nd and 3rd of September, they were right here at Tynmouth.
So it was sheer chance that
absolutely, absolutely. They were looking around, who's got a van? Quick, we must get some. And they came here, and it just happened. They picked the right chap, actually.
But the real ones were substituted.
Of course, it was a switch. We realised. The brigadier, many years after the war, who was acting governor of the tower, he was looking for information as to what happened to the crown jewels. And I think it was in the Telegraph he was making the inquiry, and I got in touch with him. I was looking for the letter with my dreadful filing system. I can't find the letter, but we had some nice correspondence together after that. Well, there's a wartime story for you.
Apart from this incident, did the war affect your father's business at first?
Yes. They were taking staff. There were temporary staff. He had to work harder. He was getting up towards retirement age, really. And he was driving his bus. He should have been looking forward to retirement, but he couldn't. I had one brother with a bad ear who was excused. Another brother, for other reasons, didn't go. Then another brother did go. He joined up in very early 40. In the RESC, which was the same as my father, in the First World War, that is. And he ended up as a desert rat. Strange enough, I met him over there in the desert later, but that's another story. But actually joining up was pretty amusing. The brother who was driving around here had to take a vehicle up through Exeter, and I was going up by appointment for my medic. And although it was coming up to the end of April, it was still a pretty chilly day. So he said, look here, though, you'll have to strip off, and it'll be damn cold. So you really want to do a widdle when you're cold. So I should go in the toilets on the way up to Castle Hill and make yourself comfortable before you go. Well, the first thing that happened when I went into the into the recruiting room was, will you fill this bottle? Well, of course, I'd just been. So I couldn't oblige very well. And it was an absolute pantomime. There was this ancient major trying to encourage me to to do a widdle, and he thought that whistling might help. There was this major whistling away at me, and I still couldn't oblige. I had to have a glass of water and wait for 20 minutes before I could go. It was quite a pantomime. I remember the sergeant was of the guards. And I told him I wanted to join the RASC because my brother was in the RASC and I'd already been advised of KRRs, King's Rules and Regulations, where a brother could claim a younger brother into the same unit with him. I think this was quite a legal thing, military thing. And he said, oh, now, look, fellow of your height, no, you're guards material. You don't want to go in a thing like the RASC. The guards is for you. They're fine boys up there. You'll enjoy going in the guards. Come on, I'm putting you in for the guards. And he was very persuasive. And that is how I joined the Coldstream Guards, with his great persuasion powers.
Which month is this?
The end of April 1940.
And whereabouts?
Exeter, in the old... what had been a chapel in Old Castle Street at Exeter. Later it was the British Legion Club. So when we had our association meetings, regimental association meetings, for many, many years, half a century after, we were still meeting in the room where I joined up. Now, of course, we were having glasses of beer there and having regimental meetings.
What was your next step that you remember?
A rail warrant for Caterham. And I remember going, I wasn't all that worldly, that was my first trip to London. I got to Waterloo, and it was some time before the train was due to go down to Caterham. And I went into a local pub there and thought I'd be a man and have a half a drink, half a pint of beer, bitter. And it started to rain. And I was always, I used to read those William Hickey type articles in the Daily Express, and I used to believe everything I read then.
You mean gossip columns?
Gossip columns. And he used to write about Lady so-and-so, and this lady, very smart lady, came in wearing a fur coat. So I thought, this must be one of the society ladies that Hickey writes about. Until she looked over at the barman and shouted, "Call Fred, it's pissing down outside!" I remember, I thought, perhaps she's not one of William Hickey's ladies after all. Anyway, I got to Caterham, by which time it was getting dark. And I rattled the gate, and I heard bang, bang, which of course was a guardsman coming up to attention from the attic. "Yes?" I said, "I've come to report." "Sergeant!" And the sergeant came out. And I had to march behind a guardsman escort with the sergeant shouting, "Left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right." I thought, gosh, I didn't know what had hit me. And I got into this dormitory. They were making beds on the floor for the reception. We didn't have a barrack room yet. Just beds on the floor. And these were the fellows that I would know through life and death for the rest of the war. Because there's a wonderful thing about the Guards. It's rather like a family regiment. You're inclined to keep together as a family. It's tough, but it's still personal. Wonderful.
Was it tough at Caterham?
My God, it was tough. One of the toughest things was that I'd never known how to wear one of those rough wool sack-like shirts. I'd always had cotton. And when I wore this, gosh, it pricked like hell. I was most I hated it. I could hardly move anything. It was agony to wear. Well, something you had to get used to. And a trained soldier, a guardsman, he's just a guardsman, but he has his emblem, trained soldier, on his sleeve. And he had the power of what in other regiments would be like a sergeant major. He was very powerful. And the squad instructor was usually either a lance corporal or a lance sergeant. And they were powerful indeed. They had the power over the men under them of someone very senior. And my golly, they showed us in a very brutal way how to spit and polish, how to get our boots up with like glass. Now, the first month or so we were in shock. And then we cottoned on to it. And then we had a kind of a pride in what we were doing. And later on, we enjoyed being guardsmen. It was great. It's difficult to explain. After the initial shock.
How do you get the shine on the boots?
I had a particularly bad pair, which were rather like pigskin toes. And I was taught to use the back of my toothbrush and get kiwi polish and rub it in, rub it very hard, and spit. But some of the old soldiers knew that spit was less polishable, for use of a better word, than water. Those who knew would put the lid upside down and put a little water in it. Pure water was much less greasy than spit. And you got a better shine. And we learned all these things. We used to have shining parade for 1 hour each evening. You sat on your bed and you polished and you shone and you polished and you shone. With the trained soldier walking up like a vulture looking at you. But my God, we did get results.
Did you have to buy your own kiwi?
I think we did. Yes. Yeah. Yes. In the Naffy. I remember now.
Did you get punished at this stage?
The punishment, the worst punishment I know was being chased on drill parade. That was punishment enough. That was to get chased on drill parade, no matter. To get chased would be doing things in double time, even treble time. And I remember the inspection. This was the fourth week inspection by the adjutant. The adjutant was Lord Brownlow of the Grenadiers. Remember, all regiments were mixed at the Guards Depot. It was the Guards Depot. And he came, and I think the very first guardsman had a bit of mark on his fingernail holding his rifle, and he noticed a little black mark on the edge of his, possibly where he just caught his boot or something and putting it on. Otherwise he was spotlessly clean. He looked and saw this. March them away, corporal, they are filthy. And that meant we had failed from the start. And of course the order to the corporal was chase them, and he chased us up and down the parade ground. It was quite some sweat, I can tell you.
So it was a collective punishment?
A collective punishment. We had more collective punishments than individual punishments at that stage. We seemed to.
So you could be punished unjustly for the shortcomings of a...
Absolutely. But teamwork. This was an object lesson, teamwork.
Were there some of the recruits who just couldn't make it?
Yes. Because we were recruits, not guardsmen yet. Guardsmen was our first promotion, and you became a guardsman when you went through successfully all the tests and examinations. Until then, you were a recruit.
How tall did you have to be?
Even then, they expected people to be about 5'11". They didn't want shorties, not even in 1940.
How tall were you?
Then I must have been about 6'1½". I think I'm 6'2½" now. I suppose I was still a growing lad at the age of 20. You still grow a bit until 21. But a rather strange thing had happened already before, and it was quite unbelievable. Lord Brownlow, incidentally, with Mr. Wadiloff, they were the ones who escorted Mrs. Simpson across France to the villa where she was going to be married to the Duke of Windsor. Do you remember they had a rather, well, you won't remember, but they had a rather adventurous journey across France, trying to escape the press, who were hounding them like a pack of wolves. And Lord Brownlow and Mr. Wadiloff, later Captain Wadiloff of Coldstream, they were the escorts just before the war, before the wedding, Mrs. Simpson, who was later the Duchess of Windsor. But it was Lord Brownlow who was the adjutant, wealthy man, lived at Belton House, deviating a bit, was the finest Queen Anne house in England, said to be, but he was wealthy. I remember we were not allowed to go past Croydon. That was our limit. Trams were running from Colston, near Caterham, right up to Westminster, over Blackfriars Bridge, along the embankment, and back over Westminster Bridge. Sergeant, what was he called? I forget his name. A Grenadier Sergeant used to be on duty outside the Greyhound at Croydon, making sure that nobody was on tram going past.
This is not Britain, is it?
Not Britain. I knew him later. And he was looking eagle-eyed, and the tram stopped outside the Greyhound, and the two of us, we were there bending down, undoing and redoing up our boots, and the other passengers wonder what the hell we were doing this for, because the tram seemed to stop there a hell of a time, and we could feel the sergeant's eyes boring through the blasted tram. We dare not put our heads up. The tram eventually moved on, and we got up to London, and for some reason my pal wanted to see someone, and we parted company. I went along Piccadilly, and an air raid started, one of the few daytime air raids out there, and so I took cover, going into the Prince's Bar along Piccadilly, which is near Fortnum and Mason. Not many people in the bar, but I walked down to the long room, to the bar at the end. There was a fellow in a very smart suit, a smart tweed suit. "Hello, guardsman. Will you have a drink?" I go, "Well, thank you, sir." "Give the guardsman a whiskey." Well, I never had a whiskey before, but I thought, well, he's paying, so I'll have. And I had this whiskey. And he said, where are you from? So I thought it was safe to tell him, I'm up from Caterham. "Oh, how interesting. I'm the adjutant." Now, on that parade, when he came to inspect us, he made eye contact and looked long and hard. And obviously he didn't quite recognise, he wasn't sure. So I got away with it. But I was very much out of bounds in those early days, going right up to the West End, which was taboo.
What do you remember next?
Ah. Well, I remember going, getting bronchitis and going into Shenley Hospital in Hertfordshire for my 21st birthday. That was in 1941. We then did a series of training right down in Devon too, at Ilfracombe Way, across the reservoirs and so on. We were getting ready, obviously, to go into summer. One of my favourite stations was in Albion Street, which is known as Regent's Park Barracks. Regimental Sergeant Major Britton in charge. He wasn't bad, actually. I got then with the with the MTs, Motor Transport Section, and one of my duties, sometime, was to drive Tibby Britton down towards Buckingham Palace and James's Palace, where he would make a quick inspection of the guard. He never let them know what time he was coming or if he was coming. He would sometimes go. And it was an open Austin 8. And when he got in, of course, he was such a massive fellow, I could feel it tilting over. And he used to love driving down through Bond Street with his arm over the door, showing the big badge of office, which we used to nickname the Fried Egg, Regimental Sergeant Major, the Lion and Unicorn. And I remember we used to drive up the Mall, and of course the guardsmen could see him coming. On this particular day, he said to me, "We'll drive down Constitutional Hill. We'll take them by surprise." I said, "Will you, sir?" "We will." So, as we went down, there was this particular guardsman, poor fella, looking down the Mall, expecting Tibby to come up the Mall, and he was fiddling with his nose, almost picking his nose. And, of course, Tibby was coming from the side. And there was one hell of a bellow that stopped that part of London. The king must have heard it. The poor fellow nearly jumped out of his skin. I don't know what happened to him. He lost his name anyway. Poor devil.
Lost his name?
Well, that means if your name is taken, you've lost your name. That was an expression. You've lost your name. In other words, your name's been taken. You've lost your name.
So Britton was called Tibby, was he?
Tibby, yes.
Why?
I don't know. I think it was probably a polite way of calling him Tubby. Instead of calling him Tubby, he was Tibby. But he was quite a character.
Any other memories of him?
After the war, he came to Tynmouth, to the hotel opposite the Golden Lion. And he would go very, very smart across the road into the Golden Lion. And I remember there was an ex-marine there who had seen him in London. And he was still with highly polished boots, very smart suit. And he said, "Excuse me, aren't you ex-regimental Sergeant Major Britton?" "Yes, I am ex-regimental Sergeant Major Britton. Don't get the whole pub, will you?" that was the character he was.
What was the attitude of the guardsmen towards him?
They a bit of fear in a way, but it was a friendly fear, for want of a better description. They knew he was a character. He was a great character.
Now, obviously, you'd gone from Caterham elsewhere because you were talking about training in...
Training in Devon, yes. A lot of training around Hertfordshire, doing route marches. We had an officer who was later the colonel of the regiment, who became Major General Sir George Burns. I knew him. I was in his pocket, really, in Italy when he was a colonel, when he was the commanding officer of the 3rd. He had a big estate.